Good morning, diners and travelers. Welcome to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig for yet another exciting hour's worth of interviews with people in the world of food, wine, and travel.
Yeah, and they're kind of from around the world.
Yeah, well.
Sort of a really mixed bag today. I think we have some Oriental influence in there. We have some British influence in there on the subject of food, always a controversial endeavor, I guess. And then we've got someone who adopted France as a country as a sort of a food therapy thing. Food therapy for her marriage, I think, as I recall. And then a topic that's on the front of everybody's lips these days, it seems, food trucks.
Well, let's start out with a fellow countryman of yours.
Right.
James Tanner, who was a delightful person to talk to.
Absolutely.
And
One thing we didn't mention in the interview, by the way, but Plymouth, in fact, Plymouth, which is where James Tanner's establishments are, is a very important place in American history, not just British history, as you probably know. It's important in British history because reportedly Sir Francis Drake was playing bowls when the Spanish Armada was sighted on the horizon in the year of our Lord, 1588. And they said, Sir Francis, the Armada is coming, and he said, not to worry, I have plenty of time to finish the game. So they finished out their bowling game on Plymouth. But the American connection, for those of you who are not into trivia as much as I am, is the Pilgrim Fathers, who were the people who founded the first permanent settlement in the United States, actually sailed from Plymouth in 1621 to found the New World, which is now, of course, these United States. So you didn't know that, did you?
I did because I was there and I read the plaque.
Yeah, we were there on the very spot.
Is that the place also where the kids ran up and down 10 million steps?
No, that's Falmouth.
Oh, okay.
That's Falmouth. No, it's the place, for lack of a better title, where they have special containers in which you can put your dog poop. And I remember being totally fascinated because they're marked dog feces only. You can't throw any other kind of trash in there.
Well, you never know what kind of subject we're going to get onto.
You never know what kind of rubbish I might come up
with. But that's a little aside from our main subject.
Anyway, Plymouth's an interesting place to go. And when you go, you got to look up James Tanner. And in the meantime, you can find out all about his wonderful recipes by listening to this interview and, of course, getting his book. So here's James Tanner.
Well, we had a little trouble connecting here, but we're all on track right now, talking to James Tanner and his book, Take 5 Ingredients, 95 Delicious Dishes Using Just 5 Ingredients, plus pantry staples, oil, salt, and pepper, right?
That's true, yeah.
Okay, and I think Peter found you cheating on one of them.
No, he said, he owned up to that. He said he had a six sneaky ingredient.
Catch me out.
But it's curious, you don't sound like a Devon man one little bit.
No, I'm not. I'm from Kent originally. So the Kent is a beautiful county in the southeast, just below London. I grew up there and then had a wonderful career in London and, believe it or not, the USA in upstate New York. I was over there for 2 years.
You know, you said it was the Rue Brothers, and where did they have a place in upstate New York?
Two sites. One was called The Point on Saranac Lake, and the other one was the Lake Placid Lodge, which is on Lake Placid.
They're Relais and Chateau places.
Indeed, yeah, both Relais Chateaus, and both years I was there, they were both graded top resort hotels by the Zaga Guide, and it was a fantastic time and an experience that has always stayed with me, and I've got a very big affection with the USA.
We were at Le Gavroche just about 3 months ago.
Okay.
In London, and we've been to the Waterside Inn several times. We know all the Rues really well, and we really love them. And
we actually ran into what's his name in the Australia food,
yeah,
in the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival.
Yeah. Well, they get around just like James does.
Yeah, James. Explain exactly what all you do. I mean, you're a TV chef. You own at least one restaurant that I know of in Plymouth, right?
Yeah, sure. So I'm based in the southwest of England, which is in the county of Devon, and in a city called Plymouth, which is a great little vibrant city down in the southwest. We've got we've actually got three sites now. We've got Tanner's Restaurant, which we opened in 1999, and when I say me, it's me and my brother Christopher. He's my business partner, and we've had a wonderful coming up for our 12 years or so now with Tanner's Restaurant, which is our fine dining restaurant. So more intricate food. And different methods of cookery, and 12 fabulous years. We've won AA Restaurant of the Year for England, which is quite a big deal for us, and really, really great, beautiful, an old, beautiful building that dates back to 1490. So it's a Grade 1 listed, beautiful old building.
Oh, wonderful.
And then our second site I've had since 2006, which is called the Barbican Kitchen Brasserie. And that's because it's on Plymouth Barbican. And it's also housed in the same building where they make the Plymouth Gin. So Plymouth Gin, as you know, a great cocktail barman's port globally.
Absolutely,
and a great,
yes.
Yeah, a great brand that we are associated with. And we've got a brasserie site there. Very, very busy brasserie operation. Same suppliers, all local food, just cooked a lot simpler. And big volume, big numbers there as well. And very, very funky, vibrant place. And recently, more so, over these past 3 months, we've just opened up another site called the Kitchen Cafe. And it's kind of an offshoot of the Barbican Kitchen. So it's just a great cafe that does great ground coffee, muffins, cupcakes, cookies, sandwiches, and just stuff for the general people around the area in the offices and people that want to grab a quick bite. You can take in, eat in or take out, that kind of thing. So we've kind of got something in each market in the marketplace of Plymouth. Yeah, sorry, further to that, my TV side of things, I've been doing television now for probably about 8 years, and really, really enjoy doing it.
Well, you're really cute.
It's very kind of you. You're making me blush at the ever
well,
other
you
place,
know,
when you say that.
I'm always pleased to get photographs of chefs on books where they're not fat.
Now, you're beginning to sound a little bit like another Jamie who hails from Essex.
He does indeed, yeah, Jamie's from Essex. He's a bit more well-known than I am, I think. But
he's having a hard time in Los Angeles, I'll tell you.
I've been reading the news and all that thing. But his style of food, obviously, he's got a lot of offshoots from his background's very different. He was more obviously traditional Italian, rustic Italian kind of food. And I suppose with me being involved with the ruse, it was more classical French.
Right.
But what really opened my eyes up was when I went to America and saw different ingredients, different foods, and a big mixture of a fusion of food, and I just found it very, very inspirational, and brilliant put in with the classic way that I was taught to see some different techniques and some more modern styles.
Now, let's also emphasize for those of you who think that England begins and ends in London, you absolutely have to explore all the way to the southwest and stop in Plymouth along the way. And the county of Devon is one of the most productive agriculturally in the whole country.
Do you know our friends at Percy's?
Yes, I do.
They're good friends, yes.
But you were just saying, Devon is to us and to a lot of people in the UK, it's kind of known like the larder of England. Great arable and pastoral farming, and also, obviously, we're by the coast, which is a bonus. So, like, myself with my seafood, I'm when I worked in London or even in upstate New York, it was you made the order, the fish came from the fish market down in New York City or London, it will come from all around the southeast. But here I have guys that actually go out for me and rod and line catch stuff.
Oh, that's fabulous.
So he'll phone me 15 miles out and I'm like, okay, what have you got? And he's like, okay, right, I've got some line caught sea bass, we've just picked up some turbot. We've got some bream, we've got some brill, we've got that kind of thing. And then as he's telling me, I'll jot it down, and then we'll incorporate that on the menu. So by the time I actually get into my kitchens, it's only been on land for 2 hours.
Right. The first time we were at Gidley Park with Michael Caines, he cooked us scallops which had been diver caught that afternoon.
Yeah, definitely, I can believe it. Yeah.
And we had red Devon beef.
The
really interesting thing is we came across some kind of beef producer here in the United States who's actually growing red Devon beef.
Brilliant.
So,
I mean, it's the marbling, you know, as a chef, you grade it on like the kind of the marbling through the meat, and the flavour is unbelievable. The Red Devon breed itself is a little bit smaller than what a lot of people are used to. So when you see like whole fillets or a whole side of beef, it is a bit more of a smaller animal, but the flavour is unbelievable. But saying that, though, from what I can remember and what I also cook with in the States, your USDA stuff was very, very good, the stuff that I used to get as well. So I think it'd be great to make a little hybrid up or something, wouldn't it? You'd get the best of both worlds.
Absolutely. Now, you decided, nevertheless, after, with all these things going on, you decided what the world needed was another cookbook from a man whose first name was James. So did this just swell from the fame of your TV show, or did you just feel like you needed to meet people in their own home, in their own kitchen?
No, very much so. It was more my little take on showing people how you can create some wonderful flavours, some fantastic food that gives you the feel-good factor of making it yourself. And they're not all of the recipes are like really ones that take a lot of time. Obviously, one of the biggest things that I really thought about when I got asked, you know, would I like the opportunity to do a book, and I wanted to do something more from the home cook, because I'm always doing chefy stuff as my job anyway. But was I understand what it's like when people go out to the store or the supermarket and they don't want recipes with massive, massive ingredients lists where they use a teaspoon of this or a pinch of that and then the rest of it sits in the back of their cupboard or their larder for the next 6 months.
Yeah, now you've really worked on paring down these ingredients and these
big
dishes.
Time. Yeah, big time, because I just thought of the bases, the base of a dish. And then you thought, okay, all you need is, say, for example, I don't know, you need the stock, you need carrot, you need onion, you need coriander, blah, 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 there's a quick soup. You've got more slow braising dishes with the slow cook individual meals, or something as simple as make it, the feel-good factor of making your own dessert or a gnocchi. And then also, I've been realistic as well. Now, don't get me wrong, in a restaurant, we make absolutely everything every day, but if you want to make a simple, great, quick tart for at home, you can easily just go out and buy some, you know, a packet sweet pastry or a packet lining paste. I'm not saying, you know, don't make everything. It's a bit of a cheat in some respects. But in other dishes, the five ingredients speak for themselves. Don't get me wrong, it wasn't easy. And there was a lot of planning and a lot of ones that I had to scribble out and think, no, I can't use that dish or I can't do that dish because I need that extra ingredient. But I really wanted the individual dishes to speak for themselves and offer something to everybody, mums, dads, young people, older people, and just something that they know. They only need a few ingredients to create something that tastes really great.
Now, we've had some chefs who've crossed the same barrier, if you like, as you have recently here in the United States, saying we want to do the same thing, and that one of the reasons that they're doing that is because dining at home, cooking at home, is not dying out, but people's lives are so busy, they think they don't have enough time, so as a result they go to these hideous fast food joints or they buy pizza and bring that in rather than actually cooking in the kitchen. And it's,
yeah.
Now, is that same thing happening in the UK?
Unfortunately, yeah. And also, it's like you said, it's people's lifestyles, the hours that people need, that have to work now because of pressures of work, and also convenience. If you have a long, you know, you have a long day at work, or you know, you've got to pick the kids up from school and get them all sorted and get them to bed. You know, before you know it, it's late, and they just think, oh, I just haven't got the time, but. The case is, as long as you've got a sharp knife, a clean chopping board, and a couple of good saucepans or pots to cook in, anything's achievable. And also, you know, you don't have to recreate the whole cooking thing. Just keep it quite simple. Keep a few ingredients in your store cupboard, and anything's achievable. But it doesn't have to cost you the earth, and it doesn't have to take you forever to do that.
No, I thought your fish dishes were particularly good. Because they're sort of tidy. You basically get everything together and then wrap it in foil and put it in the oven, and it's just that simple.
Yeah, that's one of my favourites, the one you just mentioned there. But so, so simple, massive, massive flavour. And with that recipe, you've hit the nail on the head straight off, because it is that one is all preparation, and the easiest part is you just chop some things up, mix in a bit of soy, that kind of thing, and some scallions, and put it into a foil bag, cook it on your oven top, hey presto, you've got a wonderful tasting fish that's not overcooked and tastes wonderful, and it's cooked in literally 6 to 7 minutes. I think a lot of people are more so, I know from the customers that I get at work and people that I talk back into the UK, a lot of people are scared with seafood and fish, but the easiest thing is it cooks so quickly and you don't want to overcook it. You want to retain that moisture and flavour and protein. And it really is a simple, quick, healthy alternative that can have big, big flavour and tastes great for all the family.
Yeah, you seem to be going for the big flavours.
Mm,
impact.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, I've only got 5 ingredients per recipe, so I had to.
Your toad in the hole recipe, and the secret to the toad in the hole is to buy really good sausages to begin with.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, that's my mum's recipe from when I was growing up as a kid. And if it was good enough for me, and I think it's good enough for any kind of family. And it's that to me is comfort food. And also, you think about it, it's a quick batter that you just knock together, leave to rest for a bit, roast off a few sausages, pour in the batter, put it into the oven. Yeah, it's going to take around 15 minutes to cook or so, 20 minutes to cook, but while it is, you could be doing something else that you need to get done at home, or add a bit of cream potato with it, something as simple like that, and a nice gravy, and it's a homely, feel-good kind of food. And then on the other end of the spectrum, yeah, you can have something that's a bit more delicate, not quite as heavy, a bit lighter. And I think that's the exciting thing about food. It's always evolving, it's always changing, and a repertoire of so many different flavours globally now with like a multicultural cuisine. I think that's the exciting thing about it.
I can think of one extraordinarily good reason why someone, especially someone with a sweet tooth, would want to add this book to their collection of easy-to-fix recipes, because the final flights section, as you call it, really has some wonderfully rich examples of what the English sweet tooth really loves.
No, definitely. I mean, I love my chocolate in a dessert. It's really, really great. But then again, I understand other people like a citrus kind of idea, you know? Like, say, for example, like a lemon tart to me is lovely and cleansing, really nice. If you want to be a bit more chefy, and it sounds being chefy, but it's really not, like the raspberry and passion fruit roulade is a real showstopper when you put it down at the table, but you won't believe how easy that is to make. I just think it's great on flavour, and I do a lot of my cooking here seasonally, so like when berries are in, for me raspberries, obviously I've got a little bit longer to wait till kind of like mid to end summer, that kind of thing. I'll use them, and I'll use them in my food, and you can have something rich, you can have something heavy, or you can have something light, like figs with honeys, really, you know, that's way easy, simple, and if you're cooking outside, put that in a bit of foil on a barbecue as well. It's stuff you can tweak and change, and that's what I really like about it. Or you could have a traditional, crumble, I think you call it a cobbler in the US.
I think it's essentially the same thing.
Yeah, definitely. But that's really great and simple to do, and it's no fuss, big flavour. That with some vanilla ice cream, I think everyone would be happy.
The photographs are luscious. You're making me hungry just looking at this book. And the recipes, they're well within most people's reach, as long as your ingredients are good.
So it's
exactly.
So it's called Take 5 Ingredients, and it's James, not Jamie, Tanner.
James Tanner.
King James the 7th.
Thank you.
Or something like that. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today, all the way from Plymouth. And next time we're in your neighborhood, we're going to come look you up.
That sounds fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And stay with us, because we'll be back after a short commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are, just as Peter said we would be back. And the next guest, I was a little confused at one point when I noticed their Twitter postings. Was this a think tank? Was this a blog? Was this a book? Was this a kitchen research arrangement? Was it anyhow,
turns
it was
out,
all of those.
Yeah, turns
everything.
Out it's, it, turns out it's all of those.
It's absolutely amazing to get your head around all this couple does. And it's the book, Ideas in Food, which is also the name of the blog website, and it's subtitled, which gives you a clue, Great Recipes and Why They Work. And it's Aki Kamozawa and Alexander Talbot. And Aki was not on the line, but we did talk to Alex, and here's what he had to say about Ideas in Food. Well, I follow on Twitter someone called Ideas in Food, and I was a little concerned about who it was, or was it a person, was it a research company, was it? And it turns out that there was a cookbook produced, and Ideas in Food is Aki Kamozawa and H. Alexander Talbot. We're going to call him Alex. And the book is Great Recipes and Why They Work. The title is Ideas in Food. And I guess as we were chatting a bit, Alex, you have actually a research a consulting firm?
We've got a consulting company. It's Ideas in Food.
Okay.
And we are chefs for chefs.
You're chefs for chefs, okay.
And so our goal is to make chefs better.
Oh, that's good.
Chef hires you and says, I want to learn how to do this?
Exactly.
Okay,
or we work on creativity, or we look on, you know, understanding the best way to prepare an egg for, let's say, a dish they're working on. Or we help break through a barrier of thoughts and frustration that they may be having. Or we might come to their restaurant and work with their entire team in understanding hydrocolloids, or perhaps getting a better understanding of transglutaminase, or even just looking at the most efficient way to make no-knead brioche.
Now, when did you develop your interest in kitchen science? You and Aki met in 1997 at Clio in Boston, which was not really very experimental, was it?
Actually, Ken Wellinger was always at the cusp of what was coming to the forefront of cooking. So being in that kitchen at the time, we were actually at the cutting edge of cooking from the beginning. And our interest in science is really an interest in the hows and whys of what's going on in food, understanding what's how to make something better, tastier, more efficient. And I think that's what cooking is in general. There's a whole movement on kitchen science. Ironically enough, if you look at the definition of what science is, it resembles pretty much what you do on an everyday basis in kitchen, you know, looking at something, how it reacts, trying to make an educated guess for the results, and then testing those results and seeing if it's actually edible.
And some people do that. Some people don't do that till the food gets out in front of the diner.
That's poor research then, or poor execution.
Or they didn't find out about Aki and Alex yet.
Perhaps.
So, now, I mean, you don't have a science background. You're both professional chefs.
Correct. I received an English major from Colby College in Maine, and Aki went to New England Culinary Institute in Vermont.
Right. So she was in Montpelier?
She was.
Okay, great. Nice little town.
That's what she says. I haven't visited.
Yeah, it is pretty. I like Montpelier in France better.
Montpelier, Vermont's a lot closer.
Well, let's give an idea here of what you cover in this book.
Okay. I mean, the book really turned out to be the handbook that Aki and I always wish we had as cooks and as chefs and as really folks interested in food. We talk about understanding salt. I mean, we put salt on so much of our food, but really understanding it. And we ended up fine-tuning and discovering a ratio to the amount of salt that we can actually see.
Yeah,
in our food.
I saw that. I thought that was very interesting, that there was a ratio. I wonder if we all do that, if our palates automatically do that, where it relates.
In fact, they do, because we've applied it and thrown it out to other chefs themselves. And really, once they start weighing and measuring, that salt to taste becomes very, very right on the, no longer necessary, because they can salt to the ratio and really get incredible results.
Does Ruhlman do that in his book?
In ratio? I don't believe so.
Yeah, interesting.
So he talks about ratios, but he doesn't get as close to the real thing as you do.
Oh, I think he gets probably very close. We're big fans of ratios in cooking. For us, though, the salt ratio was a really a lovely discovery for us.
Oh, I was amazed, actually. We just interviewed Bitterman, who wrote Salted.
Okay.
And followed the postings of Harold McGee about the book, in the New York Times.
Okay.
Yeah, because, you know, a lot of these kitchen science people just say it's all sodium chloride and don't acknowledge the differences.
Right.
I mean, it started out that way. He seemed a little bit ambivalent about the whole concept of salt.
Well, we found that salt may have different flavors, but really a lot of it is the textures.
Right, that's exactly what Bitterman says.
Again, salts are the artisanal salts that we see. I don't know if we can really taste the difference in those salts unless they've been flavored or seasoned in some form or another. What we can feel, though, is the variety of textures, and those textures help accentuate and deliver salt in different ways, and that is really why we're finding appreciation for them.
Right. Now, you go through various processes, such as smoking, seasoning and preserving, bread, and you illustrate each point you're making on how it works, whatever it is you're doing, with the recipes as an illustration.
Yeah.
Is that a fair way of describing what you're doing?
I mean, that's the process is, the recipes are relatively simple, but they kind of have twists on originals, or they have explorations on what's possible. I mean, in the instance of bread, we look at no-knead bread. We make a no-knead pizza dough, which is something, pizza is very strong to us, but very important to us. And then we make a no-knead brioche bread, which is something that's usually labor-intensive. And here we've taken out the labor and the thought, lots of sitting over a mixer and adding butter bit by bit, and we mix everything together, put it on top of the refrigerator, and the following day we have brioche.
Right.
So our approach is both to blend the hows and whys with a good culinary, good twist of creativity, as well as adding functionality.
Yeah, and we might point out that you have the bulk of the book is for everyday cooks, but you also have a section for the professional chef.
Yes, and while it's divided between everyday cook and professional, we really believe both sides are important to both parties. The no-knead brioche is is great for professional kitchens.
Mm-hmm.
And understanding xanthan gum is great for a home cook, because they can make better applesauce or better free vinaigrette. The big divider, I think, is it's not so much the content as opposed to the availability of the ingredients to be able to use them.
And the equipment, right?
And some of the equipment.
Right. Now, I was amazed by your preserved lemon recipe. I've never frozen preserved lemons and preserving them.
It works out really well. What's happening is, again, we spent a lot of time out in Colorado in a remote area.
And so
being in a remote area, we had to figure out ways to preserve lots of ingredients, because we'd get small shipments on a somewhat irregular basis. And so when we had beautiful Meyer lemons, we didn't want them just to sit in the walk-in, and so we ended up simply slicing them and freezing them and thawing them, and we started realizing that we could use the freezer, it's freeze-thaw cycles, for putting things in and out of the freezer to help break vegetables down without having to cook them and do a lot to them. We did that with asparagus and then applied it to preserving lemons.
Yeah. I always thought it was a lot of work. I love preserved lemons, but I think that people in the Middle East probably keep them longer than what's recommended for a month. I don't think they make it all of the time.
They probably also have somebody making them for them.
That's true.
Which, right. Which, a lot of those lemons are jacked with salt, whereas ours are
sugar,
they are seasoned. These are not salt bombs. You don't have to sit there and rinse them afterwards. I mean, you just take them out and you start chopping them up and use them.
Yeah, but you use them with sugar and salt.
We use sugar and salt, certainly. There's a nice, you'd like to have balance in food.
Yeah.
Now, I have a basic question we should have asked earlier in the interview. I mean, how did you actually figure all this stuff out?
That's a fabulous question. Making lots of mistakes.
Okay, so what you have is the successful results after literally dozens of experiments.
It is. I mean, and that's really why people come to us for on a number of levels, is because we're kind of the cliff notes. We've made a lot of the mistakes. We certainly haven't made every mistake yet, because otherwise we'd have run out of things to do. And it's exciting because we can then share both the failures, because we can show the roads that we shouldn't have taken, as well as the results that were quite successful. And we have both sides of the coin to be able to share with individuals.
Yeah, I took your egg chapter as an example, because I've been cooking jumbo eggs four minutes after the water boils for not a hundred years, but quite a long time,
and
because I know that's exactly the degree of runniness my wife would like with her breakfast eggs, which I carefully take out. She has two every breakfast time, and I'm usually the one who cooks them and takes them out of the shell and presents them in a little bowl.
But you
start with the water boiling.
Yes.
And with is it a large or an extra large egg? You say
large.
5 minutes and 15 seconds is just the right time.
We use large eggs.
And those are probably both correct. The difference is one you're starting with boiling water, the other you're starting with water that's run from the tap cold.
Sure. And the question is what's the temperature of your water when it comes out of the stove, and how many eggs and what size pot, and how long does it take to actually heat up?
Yeah, and I do them the same way every day, and they come out the same every day.
So you've got a perfect results.
Well,
based on the way you look at it. And the question is can you then share that same information and pass it off to 100 other people and have them do it?
Well, obviously I don't need to do that, but I would sometimes like to be able to explain to an Italian kitchen exactly what it is that I'm talking about, so the eggs that they serve would come out the same way as the ones I cook at home. But, of course, it can't be like that. But the fascinating part of it is the amount of science, the amount of discovery that you provide before you even talk about, now this is actually how to do it. I thought that was really fascinating. I mean, it's a book about food science. It's almost impossible to put it down because you're wondering what secret is going to be on the next page.
And what I love about it is it tells you really things that you didn't know you didn't know. I mean, there's so much we don't know.
And it's slightly more approachable than Harold McGee.
Oh, yeah.
Harold McGee would make better brick chicken, but other than that, he's a little bit harder to understand.
Well, I mean, thank you for, I mean, it really is about discovery, and I think you guys nailed it right there. And I don't think it's really exciting. It is, we wouldn't have actually been able to do any of this discovery without someone like Harold McGee really breaking down the barriers and taking a look at things. I
mean, okay, so you think you would say he sort of did it first, and that was the stimulus for you to feel
sure.
You could do
this.
Oh, yeah.
I'm instrumental in the growth and development of cooks.
It took
all over the world.
Yeah, he took 15 years to bring out the revised second edition.
Yeah.
So it's thorough. I trust him a lot. I mean, and Heston Blumenthal admires him a lot too, and I know there are a lot of chefs who do not admire some of the people that are populist in kitchen science, because there are a lot of them out there that don't add up to anything. But Harold McGee, I trust. So we talked to Hervé Tisse.
Yep.
We interviewed him. And it's interesting that his purpose for getting involved in kitchen science is so totally different from, say, like Heston Blumenthal's or Ferran Adrià or Harold McGee or anybody. I mean,
well, he does a little bit. He does a little bit of that working with Pierre Gagnaire and some of the other people that he works with. But I don't know. We had the opportunity to meet and talk to him in person for probably an hour or so. And we realized that what he was talking about, what his goal is, he's being able to feed people by creating food without having to grow it, which is a really fascinating area to be working in, recognizing that even though Thomas Malthus died a long time ago with the wrong idea, maybe we do have a Malthusian effect in our future, and a way to avoid that now, rather than over-fertilizing fields and that kind of stuff, is to actually be able to create foods that are satisfying and good-tasting to eat without having to go through the process of actually growing the meat, fish, and veg.
Well, I just read an article today about the experimentation of stem cells in Petri dishes growing meat.
Now we have another person on the program, do we not, Alex? Would you like to introduce?
My daughter wants to count.
Your daughter wants to count. How old is she?
She wants to count. Lovely kiddo.
Yeah.
I think we better let you go back to your child minding duties.
Tell me this, Alex. What exactly is your website, and do you entertain questions from people who visit your website?
We do. We love to entertain questions. In fact, our book is really the result of people asking us questions.
Okay.
So that was the catalyst for the growth in our own development, was through the blog and through people asking questions.
And
we entertain questions through Twitter, through our website, through the blog. That's what makes us better cooks and researchers and, you know, better at finding answers and what's possible with food.
And the address?
Our website's www.ideasinfood.com.
Okay, yeah, plural, nice ideas in food, yes.
Yep, it's ideas in food.
Okay, well, good luck. Keep up the good work.
Well, thanks so much for finding us and following us, and it's really been a pleasure to talk to you guys. And we're really glad the book got in your hands.
Oh, yeah.
And we're able to get a couple thoughts out of it, and hopefully it's going to be a springboard for you to bounce a bunch more ideas off us.
Yeah,
work on book two.
All the testimonials about the book are all from our favorite people, including Chris Cosentino and Sean Brock and Michael Anthony, David Chang. Yeah, so
well,
I mean, it's a well-received book, and I congratulate you on that, and much success with it, Alex, and hello, Doc.
And now another short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay. Well, hello again. Hopefully you were not in the midst of a marriage crisis, but Amy Finley was. And you may be interested in finding out how she managed to solve that problem, doing a little food therapy in France. And if nothing else, you'll enjoy all the classic dishes that she talks about in the book.
Yeah, it's really a fascinating story. And got into this one, read this one from cover to cover, and was really quite fascinated by the story, and we're sure you will be too.
Amy Finley, you really had a nice wild adventure, didn't you, in France?
We sure did, Anne. We had a really wonderful time, about 180 days spent traveling into all the nooks and crannies of a really beautiful country.
France, and your book is entitled How to Eat a Small Country, A Family's Pursuit of Happiness, One Meal at a Time. Now, let's have the premise. You won a show on the Food Network, right?
Correct.
Okay, and you were really excited about it, but your husband wasn't.
Right. In 2007, I was the third season winner of the Next Food Network Star on Food Network, and my prize was at least 6 episodes of my own show, which we titled The Gourmet Next Door, which was a concept that I came up with in the course of filming. And
by the way, I thought that was really clever. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I liked it. I mean, it was a great way to be able to do the sort of food I like in a very kind of unassuming manner, taking away some of the over pretension that people, I think,
sometimes associate
with French food.
It was very prescient in terms of who's really the star on Food Network today.
But in 2007, when I submitted my tape for the Next Food Network Star, I did know that my husband had a lot of objections. He was not interested at all in my pursuing a career in television. And to be fair to him, I did rather spring it on him. It was something that was, I kind of looked at it as a career catapult. I had been a professional cook, but I had been out of the kitchen with our two children for about 5 years. And I had hit that point that's familiar to a lot of women who go leave their careers, stay home, of wondering about how I was ever going to get back into work and get back into my career. And this seemed like, well, this was, you know, it was such a shortcut. You know, I could just launch myself from, you know, nothing into the stratosphere with one fell swoop. And like I said, I mean, he was just, was very, it was too much. He was not ready for that, was not interested in that in the slightest. And it became a real horrible point of contention for us. But more than that, it just brought up a lot of the dynamics in our marriage that were very sort of broken and fractured at that point anyways, which is we just didn't have an equal partnership. We had one person who had become very passive and one person who had become very controlling, and so we needed to fix that. And so not only, you know, did it seem there was no way that I was going to ever put, you know, being a child who went through her parents' divorce myself, but also I knew that in order for us to ever be able to get to a place where I could go back and have a career, we just needed to fix that. We needed to have a good, stable, equal partnership, working marriage again, and then we would be able to see. And I always trusted when we moved to France that we'd be able to.
Yeah, that was your solution.
Marriage, we would. Yeah, if we could fix our marriage, then there would be other opportunities that would come.
And your idea was that traveling to France and eating together was going to fix your marriage and your family and everything. That's the premise of this, right?
I knew that going back to France, my husband and I, in part, we had met in France. We were introduced for the very first time here in the States, but we really, our relationship blossomed and we fell in love when we were living in France together when I was going to culinary school. And so France was a very important foundation for the two of us. It was something that we shared. It was a shared passion. It was, and also it was a way to get away. Very few families, very few marriages exist inside of a bubble. You know, you've got friends, you've got family, you've got all of these other things that interact with it all of the time. And for us, having gone through such a really painful and divisive episode like as happened during the Food Network, we also just needed to get away. We needed to actually get into a bubble. And France was a good opportunity to do that because we were leaving everyone behind. We were leaving our babysitters and our family and, you know, everyone who we had sort of been able to fall back on for help. And we were going to be completely on our own. It was kind of a make it or break it situation.
So, but you started out, you said, not actually expecting this to be so much a memoir as it was to be about these, which was my first question when we were chatting about it, is mm-hmm. I picked up on the fact that there are all these different dishes that had been dominant in French culture for a long, long time that nobody was interested in much anymore. Now, you saw that as a metaphor, but you also talk about the dishes in the book. So you have to communicate on that level to the actual memoir took over.
Right, because I saw this parallel between here, this beautiful, vibrant food culture that was just sort of was changing, and in my opinion, not always for the best, because of sort of benign neglect and this sort of, it was being sort of sacrificed to convenience. And I saw so many parallels between that and what was happening with my own life and why I was in France and what my husband and I were working on with our marriage, that it became you said it was a metaphor, to be able to lay those two different stories side by side and use one to help people understand the other.
I see. So now I can remember eating a sausage-type product called andouette.
Oh, uh-huh.
They cover a whole wide variety of different foods, some of which are even more bizarre than andouette. But, but andouette itself.
And andouette is pretty adventuresome in and of itself, too.
Yeah, that's I had it once. The last time we were in, I'm pretty good with oddball foods, but it was almost too much for me.
Yeah, it's an acquired taste. It's the Cinq Ah probably is the group that you were talking about. I wish I could remember off the top of my head what the Cinq Ah stands for. But yeah, it's the association of the lovers, basically, of andouillettes. And it is. It's a challenging food, I think, for a lot of eaters because it has a particular odor that goes along with it. And
yes,
you have to sort of overcome that and all of your associations in order to then be able to appreciate the taste. And it was a food I hadn't anticipated that I would like it. I think I ordered it for the same reason as you did, Peter, is because I wanted to try it. I was very, really surprised when I found it was really enjoyable. I actually really enjoyed the flavor of it, but it was a good lesson. It was a good lesson and a good way to sort of edge into exploring some of these foods that, I think as Greg put it, he actually referred to andouillette as something that you only ate if you had to. And which reminded me a lot of what our attitudes are about sometimes, about older dishes and older food traditions, is that these were things that people ate when they had to. You know, you had to eat these because you couldn't let things go to waste. And but you think of what that means is that now we're saying we can afford to waste things, that we can afford to throw half of an animal away so that we only have to eat the best part. I actually thought there were some interesting parallels as I went along between that and marriage as well. I mean, this idea that we only want the best of everything, and yet, unfortunately, most things in our life, or fortunately, I mean, depending on how you look at it, most parts of our, most aspects of our lives, our families, our children, you know, there's good parts, and then there's the less wonderful parts as well. And accepting all of it as sort of this, you know, this beautiful, harmonious whole is something that I think we should all strive for.
Now, we've heard chefs who are into this nose-to-tail eating thing. Fergus Henderson of St. John,
right,
being perhaps the leading proponent, saying it a different way, not saying that people ate these foods because that was all they could afford or anything like that, but eating them out of respect for the fact that if they were going to kill the animal, it only seemed fair that they wouldn't throw it away. So so parts of it, since the animal had sacrificed its life, the least thing you, as a human being, you could do is to treat it with proper respect and eat all the parts of it.
Which is exactly the way I view it. I just do believe that for some, I mean, I think there's probably always been an aspect of both. I think that there's always been that very respectful attitude of, especially coming from people who are raising and producing these foods as well. I mean, you get to know a farmer who's raising pigs, and you understand, you know, when that person eats every little bit of the animal, you automatically, you know, associate with that level of respect because it's something they've had a, you know, they've had a relationship with the animal. You know, they've been, they're intimately involved in the rearing, and therefore they understand the totality of the sacrifice. But then for people who are maybe one step away from the raising of the food and the producing and whatnot, and they're just, you know, enjoying the dishes, then I think that sometimes there's also an element of, there are, you know, there's pieces of meat, there are dishes that come out of every animal that are, they're the cheaper cuts. And I think that some of those, I love to work, you know, with some of these sort of less desirable pieces because from a cook's perspective, a chef's perspective, they offer a lot of opportunity to really sort of put your technique to work.
Yeah, we're kind of moving away from this metaphor. Just to get us back to it, I want to read what Anthony Bourdain said on the back cover of your book. Unexpected and delightful memoir, How Amy Finley Slipped Under the Wire of Food Network and Into Our Homes, is an enduring mystery. Her tale of moving to rural France to preserve her marriage and family is a great read filled with joyous bites. And I think that pretty much sums up what you've been doing with this book, don't you think, Amy?
I sure hope so. I really loved what he wrote about the book, and I was very, very appreciative of his perspective on it. Yeah.
Now, from time to time, I wondered whether you weren't just also trying to shock with some of the dishes that you described and what was in them. Anne would made a habit of reading some of them to me right as I was cooking a fairly conventional dinner. And I've got a pretty strong stomach, and I like the tasty bits of most animals. Some of them were just a bit extreme. I mean, were you out to shock, or was it just telling the truth?
No, I don't think I was out to shock. You know, it's interesting. I know that a lot of people have had a strong reaction to the opening prologue of the book, where my family, where we butchered a rabbit. And I think, you know, maybe my perspective on it is this, is anything, you know, when you've done something, like butcher an animal, it becomes slightly more matter of fact to you that you know now exactly what happens, what transpires, what it looks like, what the experience is like. You know, you've kind of gone through all of the emotional reactions to it. And my emotional reactions to killing the rabbit were actually really extreme. I couldn't do it. In the end, I turned the paddle over to Greg, my husband, and he was the one who did the person who actually wielded the fatal blow to the bunny.
It's always that way. You girls are always like, you always give us the hard things to do.
Well, I actually figured that that was actually a really great metaphor for Griggs and my marriage. The reason why we work, and in fact, that's actually where that chapter came from, is I was trying to figure out what was a good way, you know, considering that I was now going to tell you about a marriage not working and some of the ways that we really failed each other, which could convince you that maybe we didn't actually have much of a marriage and that what was the point of even our trying to save it? I mean, if we had deteriorated to the point where we were sabotaging each other's careers, was that somebody you really wanted to be married to? Because it kind of called into question whether or not that was a good marriage. And I wanted to be able to explain that dynamic. Every marriage has its dynamic. And the dynamic between Greg and I, which was in so many ways that I can start things and Greg can finish things. That we, it's almost like one of us, I have the creative energy in our relationship to come up with the wild, somewhat crazy, okay, I have this, you know, this fantastical idea and it's X. And then Greg has more of the sort of measured and logical and step-by-step-by-step skills and personality to then be able to figure out how to actualize some of these things. And if you didn't have both of us, neither of us would get nearly as much out of life. And that's actually where the bunny chapter came from, was trying to explain how that in the end, it took the two of us to be able to accomplish this one task that ended up being very relevant and personal and important to both of us.
Well, it's a great read, and read cover to cover, which is rare on a number of different levels. This is a totally fascinating story. How to Eat a Small Country. I guess all we have to say is on this one we agree with Bourdain like we usually do, and thank you so much for making this contribution to food literature.
My absolute pleasure, and thank you both for your time. And
another short break before we go into the last segment of the program.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, this saga of this phenom called food trucks is ongoing, and our next guest wrote a book about it. And I think, listen up and you'll find out at least one person's take of the phenomenon called food trucks, which is sweeping the country. Anybody who hasn't got this energy from the latest wave of food trucks probably isn't vibrant in the very basic sense of living. It's very hard to miss, and we have as our guest today a woman who has actually done, I think, is this the first definitive Heather Schaus of food truck culture in this country?
As far as I know, I mean, been definitely multiple magazine articles and newspaper articles written about it, but in terms of a full-scale book, I believe this would be the first.
Okay, and it's called Food Truck, subtitled Dispatches and Recipes from the Best Kitchens on Wheels. So Heather did a fair amount of hopping around the country to get this together. How long did it take, Heather?
It was over a period of about a year, so I did some initial scouting. The idea came about after a trip to Portland, and that is considered by many to be sort of ground zero for what would be the new food truck scene. LA has always been considered to be ground zero for the entry point of food trucks as we know them in America. And so I spent about a year going to cities, going back to cities with a huge number of trucks that it was just almost impossible to cover all in one trip. So I spent multiple trips over the course of a year researching, interviewing, taking photos, circling back around to touch base with chefs and truck owners to get recipes, testing recipes, checking back in, and just deciding exactly the right sort of fit for cities and particular trucks to highlight in each city, because it's really impossible to highlight all of them. So my hope was that I could at least present a wide range of the old school and the new school, a little bit of history with a little bit of the excitement that's coming from the recent boom.
Now let's pick up that question right there. You mentioned a new wave of food trucks and then the old style food trucks. For our listeners who maybe just know about a food truck that it sells food and it's on wheels, can you draw the distinction between what you consider the two different kinds?
Sure. So it used to be, obviously, if we wanted to trace it all the way back, we could compare it to chuck wagons of the Wild West, but it then sort of evolved into the mid-century in America as construction site lunch wagons. Then we started seeing taco trucks popping up, particularly in California, around the LA area, which has the largest concentration of Mexicans in America. That happened in the 70s. So these trucks, for the most part, construction site lunch wagons, or the kind of lunch wagons you would see in Hawaii down by the military bases around Honolulu, those were essentially what we would, some people would unfortunately call them roach coaches. There was a little cab in the front where a person would drive, and then they basically had a warmer. So the food was prepared somewhere else and then loaded onto a truck, taken out to these sites and kind of dished out to order and sold there. And then in the 70s and 80s, it seemed that the Mexican immigrants who started bringing mobile food vending to a different level, they did this by taking Grumman trucks, old UPS step vans, and really outfitting them into full kitchens on wheels. So putting refrigerators in there and running water and grills and the whole nine yards. So they basically had a mobile kitchen. So this enabled them to cook items fresh and hot on the street, and that has become the model that some of the chefs in the recent years who have picked it up are really embracing, and that is legal throughout the country with the exception of Chicago. So,
oh yeah, why is that? That's it. So stupid, doesn't it?
Well, it's a little silly. You know, they're currently working on overhauling those regulations, and Chicago is my home base, so it's kind of ironic that the city I live in after writing this book is the one place where you can't get authentic food trucks.
I must say that, in fact, it's not a simple matter. You've got your health department involved. You've got the competition it gives to bricks and mortars restaurants.
Sure.
And you have to choose location. But I guess where it sort of seems very current because it mobilizes on the basis of social media.
Correct. Yeah, and that varies from city to city. So a city like Portland, they use the carts as their model. They're actually not engine-based automobiles. So it's more of a trailer that you would attach to a hitch, and they would use a truck or a van to pull it into its spot. And they have permanent spots.
Yeah,
so
they do.
They park and they use what's known as a pod. You know, you might see five or six carts in one pod. And that's where they are all the time. They're not moving. It's essentially a food court on wheels, but it doesn't move. And so for their case, they use Twitter or Facebook mainly just to let people know, oh, it's raining today, we're not going to open, or, you know, we have a new special on the board this week. But they're not embracing social media so much as cities like L.A., where the current regulations insist that they move. They have a maximum amount of time that they can actually park in one space. Likewise, in Washington, D.C., the trucks are not even allowed to pull over unless there is already a queue for their truck. It's an old ice cream truck law that has still persisted on the books. So trucks like the Fogel Brothers and Merlindia, a very popular truck in D.C., they use their Twitter to basically send it out to everyone in their network and say, hey, guys, we're in this area. Do you want to stop? And their fans actually respond directly to them, tweeting back, yeah, we've got a line waiting for you at this corner. And once the line is formed, then the truck is allowed to park. And without social media, that model would be virtually impossible.
Now, is this a little bit like the street food vendors that are so celebrated in places like Singapore and Hong Kong and in India and in Africa and places like that?
You know, it's not so different in cities like Portland where they are stationary because they're smaller and they're those carts and you see them side by side, you know, as I've seen in Beijing and as the famous food markets in Singapore are. Essentially, they are definitely cooking directly on the street. They are regulated just as a restaurant would be. They undergo health inspections, but it just so happens that they happen to be on wheels. So, yeah, it definitely creates a really vibrant street food scene in terms of getting the community out, having people interacting, standing, talking, waiting in line, and it really breaks down the barriers of, you know, everything from racial to socioeconomic barriers, because basically it doesn't matter who you are. There's no VIP reservations. You can't skip the line, you wait in line, you pay cash like everyone else, and you get your food. And that, I think, is one of the really big, interesting points to me, is how street food has really pulled our communities together in various ways. It's very interesting.
Now, you covered the country somewhat. You didn't get to every corner of it, I guess, but you did a selection of what you thought were some of the more unusual and newsworthy, I guess, food trucks around the country.
Yeah.
But how did you imagine that someone would use this book?
Well, ideally, it's three parts, really. It's first part, sort of a travel guide that you can, a travel companion that you can look at, and you know that you're going to San Francisco. You can flip right to that page or that portion of the book, those few pages, and see what in San Francisco you should try to check out. So that's one element of it, using it as a travel guide. There are a lot of links to, a lot of mentions of Twitter feeds, websites. You can check out these trucks before you actually get to a city and know, okay, this truck interests me. I'm definitely going to hit this up when I get to town. And then secondly, it contains recipes, about 50 recipes from truck chefs throughout the country of every ethnicity you can imagine. It goes from Vietnamese to Mexican to French to classic American to contemporary American. So I wanted also to be a kitchen companion, and these recipes come directly from these chefs. They've been tested by me, so I'm hoping that people will use it to create.
My questions. I wanted to know who tested the recipes. You mean you tested all these recipes?
Yes, ma'am.
Wow, in your kitchen?
Yeah, I did, in a home kitchen. Yeah, and simultaneously while I was working on this book, just as a side note, I was working on a cookbook with Stephanie Isard, who is a Top Chef winner, and she owns a restaurant here in Chicago called Girl and the Goat.
So the Girl and the Goat. She's a finalist for the Beards.
Yeah, she's a finalist for Best New Restaurants for James Beard, and we announced 2 weeks ago that she is one of this year's top 10 best new chefs in America,
right,
as voted by Food and Wine magazine.
Yeah, I've never been there.
She's having a great year.
Yeah, I've never been to a restaurant.
Visit when you come to Chicago. So yeah, so at the same time, I was working on Stephanie's book and working on this, so there was a lot of recipe testing going on. It's very different producing something out of a kitchen, a normal home kitchen, than it is producing out of a $50,000 mobile kitchen on wheels like some of these guys have, some of the bigger trucks do, or producing it on a tiny little cart underneath a subway station in Queens.
I have trouble distinguishing what I'm following here. Hanging around a local university for years have been these, they are on wheels, they are mobile, although they stay there, and it's all ethnic food. They've been there for years and years and years. Then they've also had these barbecue outfits, these great big trucks with the grills and the, you know, really high-powered barbecue stuff that goes on forever. That's a different thing. Then there are chefs like Ludo, for example, Ludo Bites, who he really is a celebrated chef, but he's cooking, what, fried chicken or something. But I mean, it seems to me that they're all in a different category.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it to me, really, is that it is such a big spectrum. It's just like restaurants. I mean, you know, you have your low end, you have your high end, you have your pop-up restaurants now, you have your established restaurants that have been there for 20 years, and that's the excitement of it. You know, people want to see the old school 25-year-old taco truck in L.A., East L.A., that's been serving a part of the community that knows that this is the best place to go for Al Pastor tacos. That is one thing. If they want to try to use Twitter to kind of embrace the excitement of tracking down a truck doing really unique food, such as the very popular Kogi.
Kogi. He's a trained chef, though. I mean, he goes clearly into a different category from the taco truck.
Yeah.
But anyhow, I don't know. We're not going to resolve this, I'm sure, but it certainly opens up a really big discussion about where we're going with the food trucks, I think, Heather.
Right.
So you're a brave girl to be trying all that food.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean,
Did you get food poisoning at all?
I did not.
You're lucky.
Any food poisoning, I mean, you know, I've always been pretty adventurous. I've eaten street food as much as I can around the world. So I think the only daunting part of it to me really was just trying to get to as many as I possibly could to give the readers a really great cross-section of what's out there and select the ones that I felt are truly unique and delicious and a really good representation, as you said, of the range, of the wide range from the classically trained chefs to cooks who've just been doing it day in, day out since they were kids and making family recipes. So it's an interesting spectrum to me.
Well, I hope you do really well with your book.
Well, thank you.
So, and thank you for talking to us. I can't wait to see. When is the other book coming out?
The food trucks book is officially on sale April 19th, and then the cookbook I did with Stephanie Izard, Girl in the Kitchen, is going to be available in fall, and that'll be on Chronicle Books.
Okay, so I'm sure looking forward to that one too.
Definitely. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Well, there you have it for this week's
program. I don't think, by the way, that that's the last word that you're going to get on food trucks, because it keeps mushrooming into a number of side issues.
Oh, yeah. And,
including, I think they just awarded the first liquor license to one in New York.
And Heather was quick to point out that she really covered the food trucks she knew about, but she knew there were a whole lot more out there than she could possibly include in this book. So I'm sure there'll be a Volume 2 and a Volume 3 and lots of other books like it. And if you're into food trucks, then you'll want to watch this space, because we'll be sure to bring them here to you. And in the meantime, we'll see you again, same time, same place, next week.
Bye-bye.